National Health Insurance objectives clearly are to improve coverage for everybody, try to achieve greater fairness in our system, but also, importantly, achieve what we call convergence between the public and the private systems, how they operate. And there's so many differences between these systems that need to be addressed in thinking through that.
As a contribution to the SOLDRU South Africa 30 Years of Democracy Conference, IRSA has published 9 policy papers for the 1994 to 9 policy paper series. Today, we will be discussing the policy paper on health policy in South Africa from 1994 to now, Towards Convergence Between Public and Private Health Financing by Andrew Donaldson and Tamar Khan. South Africa's transition to democracy in 1994 placed a fragmented, racially divided health system in the hands of the new ANC-led government. It quickly moved to transform the health administration of 10 homelands and 4 provinces into a single national department and 9 provincial departments in line with the new constitution. However, 30 years later, South Africa still has a health system driven by inequalities, with patients' access to care substantially determined by their socioeconomic status and where they live. It is as if the income inequality has mapped its way into the duality of the health system. One of the latest approaches to addressing this issue culminated in the formation of the 2024 National Health Insurance Act, which envisages a consolidated national health fund and a state control rather than a competitive insurance market. The NHI Act implies that prescribed minimum benefits in the medical scheme's environment will be replaced by a prohibition on insurance cover for benefits covered by the National Insurance Plan. This demands a deeper understanding of the nature of both the public and private healthcare systems in South Africa. What are the strengths and weaknesses of the existing public and private healthcare mechanisms? What is the role of collaboration between the public and private sectors? How has health policy evolved since 1994? And is the NHI a practical, good idea? To answer these questions and more, we will be joined by our esteemed guests, the authors of this policy paper. A warm welcome to Andrew Donaldson and Tamar Khan. Andrew headed the Budget Office and Public Finance Divisions of the Treasury and is now a research associate of SOLDRU, the Southern Africa Labour and Development Research Unit at the University of Cape Town. He served on the 1995 Committee of Inquiry into National Health Insurance and led the Treasury's work on social security reform in the 2000s. Also joining us, Tamar Khan has reported on health and science for Business Day since 2001. She has won awards for news, features, and analysis published in Business Day and its sister publication, The Financial Mail, and was also the recipient of a Rosalind Carter Fellowship for Mental Health Reporting. I'm Margot G, and welcome to IRSA's podcast series. Also in studio today, we have Bashir Fente, IRSA's Executive Director, who will be co-hosting the show. Welcome. It's a pleasure to have you all on our show.
Thanks, Margot.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
Great.
Hello, Margot.
Thank you. So, Tamar, let's start with you. You are a journalist for Business Day. How did you find the experience of writing this paper? Was it different to the type of writing you're used to?
Yes, it's a very different experience. I think in many ways it felt like a real luxury to be able to spend a lot of time on a single piece of work and to wrestle with ideas and to refine them and to think, reflect, come back, do some more work. You know, I work for a daily newspaper and the deadlines are tight and the turnaround time is very swift. So it's a very different way of working.
Very nice. How long did it take?
I think Andrew and I first started talking about this in July last year, maybe even a little earlier.
Okay, so you, Andrew, you spent many years at National Treasury. How was this experience? Are there any highlights you could share with us? Any advice to young economists looking to careers in public finance?
Well, the Treasury is a wonderful place to work. It's exciting, it's busy, it's working with smart people, and of course it's working on government as a whole, budget issues and public finance policy issues. I suppose for me, the highlight of my time at the Treasury was the late 1970s, 1997. We published the first medium-term budget policy statement, and then the complete overhaul of the budget process, 3-year budgeting, the division of revenue between national governments, provinces, and municipalities, and a complete overhaul of the documentation surrounding expenditure, which was introduced in 2001. And so, yes, I would say to young economists, if you want to think about an exciting career in public finance, it's not just working with obscure data sets and trying to work out mathematical relationships. It's about engaging with the issues of the day. The Treasury is an exciting place to go. And right now, as we know, there's another challenge in budget reform that the new government faces. I think it's probably a more difficult challenge than I ever had to deal with. So budget reform is really back on the agenda.
So, Andrew, when did you start at National Treasury?
I started at the time of the change of government in 1993 in a little research unit that was beginning to prepare for the change of government.
Oh, wow. And when did you leave?
I finished 6 years ago and then
Okay.
have done a bit of advisory work since then. So I was there for a long time, 25 years.
That was a good 25 years. All right. And before that, where did you go straight from university?
I was teaching economics at Rhodes University when I
All
moved to
right.
the Treasury.
Okay. Great. That's awesome.
Very nice. For sure, you've also had experience in public finance.
Yeah, so in my previous life of consulting, most of my consulting was with National Treasury and their public finance department, mostly through the line ministries themselves, looking at the costing of big government programs. I even did some work in the vicinity of Andrew when he was there, which was always a great experience. So no, I really enjoy the space as well.
Great. Okay, so I like how this paper actually pulls together and connects the health and fiscal debate together. But before we get into that tomorrow, I would like to speak to you about the NHI. So the NHI, the ANC's controversial plan for universal health coverage, dominates the health headlines today. But this wasn't the reform pathway originally embarked on by the ANC when it assumed power 30 years ago. How did it start out, and how did we get to where we are today? Well, yes, you're quite right. When the ANC assumed power in the mid-90s, then Health Minister Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma was at the helm of a policy reform pathway, which was centered on having what we call a multi-fund approach. So it saw a role for government funding healthcare, but also a strong and growing role for medical schemes. There were several commissions of inquiry, the most important of which was called the Taylor Committee of Inquiry. It had a broader mandate than just looking at healthcare, but on the healthcare front, it recommended a strong government-funded public health service, complemented by mandatory health insurance for everyone in formal employment. And the government, that's in the late 1990s and early 2000s, and up until about 2007, was intent on a reform pathway that would have had multiple funds covering the population. And at the same time, there was a strong reform pathway or series of reforms that were intended to strengthen the private healthcare sector, in particular the medical scheme industry. And this is important because the approach was kind of dual reforms. So while the process of introducing what was then called social health insurance was undertaken, the government also saw the necessity to strengthen the medical scheme industry and re-regulate an industry that had been deregulated in the late 1980s and early 90s. Then in 2007, the ANC held a key policy conference in Polokwane, at which delegates decided on a completely different pathway. They passed a resolution to introduce national health insurance. And that, I think, some of our key informants have described as a pivotal moment in time. In a tent or a building or a room somewhere out of the public eye, a small group of people decided on a completely different reform pathway for South Africa and set us on the path to NHI. One of the most significant aspects of this reform pathway is that it had a singular focus on one reform pathway, NHI. And this is a vision of a unitary system with one single funding pool that pays for healthcare for everybody. It had a chilling effect on all other reforms, and there has been very little reform at all since 2007. So a whole series of planned reforms to the medical schemes industry fell by the wayside, but also there were plans to introduce important measures in the public health system, which have also not been done. A prime example is the failure of the government to introduce any kind of national patient record system, which would allow monitoring and tracking of patient data across the country. And that brings us to where we are today, which is a health system that very much feels as though it's in stasis. There is this political push for NHI, but very little has changed in real terms for patients in public hospitals and clinics. And the medical scheme industry faces a whole host of problems of its own due to the failure to regulate in any meaningful way for, I would say, the last 15 years.
So, Tamar, I mean, that big kind of move in 2001, I mean, was it ideologically driven, would you say? I mean, it's difficult to always think about intentions, but there does seem to be a bit of a mistrust of the private sector that found its foundation there.
Yes, just a point of correction that the inflection point was 2007. And yes, it was ideologically driven. It was driven, according to our informant interviews, by a group within the ANC that was disenchanted with the economic policies of then President Thabo Mbeki, and an anxiety and distrust of the private sector and of strengthening the medical scheme market. And I think also an anxiety about creating or allowing a system to evolve in which wealthier people, people from higher income households, had access to different set kind of healthcare or different set of benefits to people from poorer households.
So, Andrew, as Tamar mentioned, the NHI's big promise is universal health coverage. That sounds great, but what are the major concerns or controversies surrounding the NHI?
Well, I suppose the first thing to say about universal health coverage is, in an important sense, we have universal health coverage. So we have 4,000 clinics, 400 public hospitals. Clinic services are essentially free. They have means-tested tariffs, but these are tariffs that don't fully recover costs. And there's really very little cost recovery, very little user fee income that goes into the public health system. But it is a congested system that can't meet all the demands that it faces. It's trying to provide health services to 85% of the population. And then for those who have medical scheme coverage, our system works fairly well, as our paper shows, in limiting the extent of what we call catastrophic expense. So the really important thing to ensure in health financing systems is that families don't face the catastrophic costs of really serious expenses associated with major injury or disease, and have access to what we call a risk pool, a pooled funding arrangement. And those exist, of course, in the private medical schemes environment, but that's a very different environment from the public hospital environment. So we have universal cover, but it's important to see that it is cover that operates through two very, very different systems. And in health economics, we talk about integrated and separated systems. An integrated system is a system in which you have funding arrangements that then go to, think of a provincial health department, a large service provider who provides those services, for the most part, directly to the patients who make use of those services. Private medical schemes environment, of course, operates very, very differently. The insurers, the funding arrangements, reimburse costs that hospitals or service providers or patients incur and pass on to them. So there's a separation between the funding and the provision of services. And one of the really central challenges of the NHI proposal, as we have it incorporated in the Act now, is that it's really hard to see how you bring together these two very, very different systems into a single system. That's the intent. The strategic intent is that everybody's healthcare, or most of everybody's healthcare, be funded through a single unitary national health fund, which will reimburse healthcare incurred in both the public and the private systems. But as I've said, they are such very different systems. The strategy that was envisaged in the 1990s and with the regulatory changes that were made to the medical schemes environment in the 1990s to ensure that medical schemes don't unfairly discriminate against members, that they don't try to exclude people with particular needs, that they're obliged to cover prescribed minimum benefits. This regulatory framework was intended to expand coverage in the medical schemes environment, relieve the burden on the public health system, but also potentially provide a revenue source for public health services, because medical schemes can pay the bills of their members either in public or private hospitals. And clearly there's some merit in a strategy that tries to approach convergence, approach greater equality in our health system from both sides, from both strengthening the public health system, but also expanding medical scheme coverage and relieving the burden on the public health system. But that strategy has been abandoned. And the strategy now seems to be to bring everybody under a single fund, to try to limit the role of medical schemes. And it seems to us implausible that that strategy in this fiscally constrained environment will lead to better outcomes. And so we're not saying that National Health Insurance's objectives are wrong. National Health Insurance's objectives clearly are to improve coverage for everybody, try to achieve greater fairness in our system, but also, importantly, achieve what we call convergence between the public and the private systems, how they operate. And there's so many differences between these systems that need to be addressed in thinking through that. So universal health cover we have in some sense at present, but we need to make greater progress in blending the public and private systems. And if I can just add a footnote to that, by international comparison, it turns out when you really look at the systems in advanced economies, they're always a hybrid. In all advanced economies, even those that have dominant single national systems like the British, the UK National Health Service, there are voluntary health insurance arrangements. There are other arrangements that meet particular needs. Every advanced economy has three or four health systems coexisting to serve various needs. And voluntary insurance and out-of-pocket payments account for an average of something like 27% of health expenditure across the richest economies in the world. So it's not unusual to think in terms of complementary systems, a multi-fund system.
So, Andrew, thanks. I have two questions that I want to ask as a follow-up. So first, as part of the proposals around medical scheme reform, they always spoke about the Risk Equalization Fund. So that's obviously within private health insurance, you have your the population that they serve has a certain risk profile, and between that might differ between private medical schemes. But there's obviously also kind of a risk differential between those that are served by the public sector right now and those that are served by private medical schemes. What happened to the idea of the Risk Equalization Fund? And you know, is there a space for that in a potential future of a hybrid system, as you've described it?
I think there certainly is space for risk equalization in a medical schemes environment. Think about many different schemes. They have different age profiles of their membership. And the basic sort of health insurance economics of this is what we call adverse selection. That if you have an insurance system, and particularly an insurance system in which you can't charge different fees to higher risk people, and that's one of the rules of our system, then the young and the healthy are going to opt out. And so we are seeing something of a decay of the representativeness of the risk pool in private medical schemes. As young and healthy people opt out, the burden of caring for the elderly and meeting the costs of the elderly rises. Private medical schemes' annual cost adjustments or fee adjustments go up, and the problem, and it becomes a kind of spiral of decay in the financing integrity of the medical schemes environment. And so a risk equalization fund goes a long way towards addressing that. One of the things that we do in this paper is, you know, if the kind of funding arrangement that the Risk Equalization Fund envisaged, a separate fund that would then equalize between funds, is not feasible, then one can do what some other countries in the world have done, which is simply implement it through the tax system. You can have a higher implicit tax subsidy for the elderly members of medical schemes that achieves a great deal of what a risk equalization fund is intended to achieve. And it could be done through the tax system in a revenue neutral way. And I think that that's the route in which we should go.
All right. Okay, yeah, so that's very interesting. And then the other question around you mentioned the other examples of countries that run, especially in advanced economies, running these hybrid systems. Are there any examples of health systems that relegate the private medical scheme sector to complementary services?
The Canadian system does that to some extent, but much more common is the kind of strategy that's implicit in the Health Market Inquiry report, which is that all medical schemes which benefit from a tax-privileged and regulated environment should be obliged to cover a standard benefit package. Ideally, it should be priced similarly across all packages, so you kind of reduce the complexity of the medical schemes environment by saying the whole of the medical schemes environment is built on a standard package that is the multi-fund analog, the multi-fund equivalent of coverage in a public health system if you still have public health delivery, or if you have a default fund that is constructed for those outside the formal medical schemes environment. So you can achieve the objectives of achieving risk equalization of funds across funds, the objectives of standardizing benefits, and also importantly, as the Health Market Inquiry tells us, you incorporate ways of regulating tariff determination and costs through arrangements that operate across the entire health insurance environment. That's in very broad terms how most European systems work. Multiple funds that in some sense are competing with each other, but do so in an environment where they're obliged to cover a standard package of services.
And it does feel like that is something that is more akin to building on the foundations that you already have rather than a process of digging up everything you have and starting from complete scratch and the bottom, which is a more enticing idea, I think, from a just an implementation point of view.
I think that's exactly right. It's really hard to see how you can take an existing industry, it's a big industry, it's got big administrators, so it covers a substantial proportion of health spending in the economy. Take a system in which there are 270 prescribed benefits they have to cover, and replace that with a system in which there's a whole range of things that are covered through a single system that they're not allowed to cover anymore. It's very hard to see how you make that decision.
Very interesting. Thanks.
Okay. So, Tamer, Andrew mentioned that there is merit in a strategy focusing on the convergence of two systems, and there has been a history of collaboration between the public and private sectors. But you also argue that the tension between the public and private sectors we sometimes hear about wasn't always as pronounced as it is today. Can you walk us through some examples from the paper that highlight this cooperation? And on the flip side, what are the risks or pitfalls of these public-private partnerships?
Actually, I would say there's always been tension between public and private. It's probably more polarized now than it has been in the past. But I don't think it's ever been an easy relationship, partly because, as Andrew alluded to, they're two very different systems. One hinges on a for-profit industry, the other doesn't, and the way they're organized is very different as well. But that said, there was a period from the early 2000s onwards where there were a number of large public-private partnerships, largely focused on infrastructure. And there was strong support from National Treasury for these projects. A good example would be the Nkosi Albert Luthuli Hospital in KwaZulu-Natal. It's a large central hospital that serves all of the residents of KZN and some from the Eastern Cape. And that was a very successful project, which is still running today. And a private partner came in and improved infrastructure and ran the equipment, put in place an electronic record system. An independent review by the World Bank concluded it was basically a good project with some interesting upsides. For instance, the hospital had far less downtime due to industrial action because the working conditions were so much better for staff that staff there went on strike less often because they could serve the patients in the way that they needed to. The equipment was working, they could get their patient records, things worked smoothly. There's also another nice example in Limpopo, a much smaller public-private partnership, which focused on kidney dialysis. So, a private partner came in to run and maintain a kidney dialysis unit and saved patients from having to travel from Polokwane to Johannesburg or Pretoria. So they could be treated closer to home rather than having an additional 2 or 3 hour trip tagged on top of their care. But South Africa's also been influenced, I think, politically by a very highly publicised public-private partnership between the private hospital group Netcare and the Lesotho government. Although it wasn't in South Africa, it got a lot of negative publicity from Oxfam, from international media, and turned largely because the project turned out to be much more expensive than the Lesotho government had anticipated, partly because of the terms of the contract and partly because it saw many more patients than it had anticipated. So this was a large tertiary hospital built in Maseru that saw far more patients because the nearby district hospitals and clinic services weren't up to scratch. So patients voted with their feet and went where they knew they would get care. It kind of had a chilling effect politically on the health department's view of public-private partnerships, to the extent that the health minister, Ramotswalele, asked the health market inquiry to look into this public-private partnership and has publicly said he was quite disappointed when the HMI said no, it was outside its jurisdiction. Right. So these the important thing about the public-private partnerships that were established in the 2000s is they were largely focused on infrastructure, and there wasn't a huge amount of collaboration that looked at clinical services. That was the focus really was on buildings and equipment.
So can I just ask then, so I just so that I understand the relationship in the public-private partnership a little bit better, especially we are mostly economists, hopefully in terms of listenership. So we like to think about incentives. So in the first example you mentioned, which is the Albert Luthuli Hospital, right? So the private partner was responsible for constructing the hospital and equipping it and maintaining the equipment. That was the kind of border of their responsibility.
No, they refurbished it. They didn't build it from scratch.
Okay. And then maintenance subsequently of the equipment? Okay. I don't imagine that in a contract like that, it necessarily is, well, the better you do, the more we're going to pay you. There's kind of a fixed term contract at the beginning with government contracting out a service provider to do this, and they are responsible for the scope of this contract. So is it really just about in the equipping and refurbishment and main subsequent maintenance about coming getting around constant procurement rules that their private sector partner isn't necessarily beholden to in the same way that a CEO of another public hospital would be? Is it just that they're the way that they can do it is a lot more quicker or a lot more nimble, let's say.
So Andrew is probably better placed than I am to answer the question about whether the private partner is somehow less bound by the restrictions of the Public Finance Management Act. I think one of the difficulties in answering a question like that is these contracts are not public in the public domain. There's tremendous opacity around all of these PPPs. And one of the issues that was consistently raised by the people we interviewed for this paper about PPPs was that there is no central repository where anyone in the sector can go and look up a contract, go and look up an independent assessment or otherwise of how these projects unfolded, which makes it very difficult when you think about trying to replicate the successes, because what exactly did they do? And these contracts are hugely varied. One of the people we interviewed made the point that there may be merit in thinking about public-private partnerships that are of a shorter duration, not necessarily these large 15, 20, 25-year contracts, but something smaller, shorter, and more easily replicable from one province to another, kind of cookie cutter approach. I mean, a large part of the rationale is that the idea is you bring in a private partner with managerial and operational management skills that may be lacking in the public sector.
For Shi, I think your opening point about incentives is what it's all about. You visit Albert Luthuli Hospital, and it's clean and neat. The equipment is up to date. It's being maintained. The information system is in place. The computers are there. It's a paperless information system, and that's because the private party doesn't get paid unless those things are done. If the equipment isn't refreshed, if there are stockouts in the dispensary, there's a penalty that kicks in. And that's the point of these contracts, is to bring in a private sector's operational agility, but also to get incentives in place that just mean that the job has to be done. And that's a big problem with our public hospital environment, where the health department's incentives is always to kind of get on with today's business and not to worry about long-term maintenance. And so you have these big maintenance shortfalls. There's a tendency to say PPPs are about bringing in the capital to build something new and big, but that really isn't what it's about. It's about the incentives to do things well. And I, as a footnote, you know, not everything is going to be done better in the private sector than the public sector.
Yeah, sure.
There's a really interesting challenge for economists here is to go and sort out where it would make sense to do this kind of contracting and where it doesn't.
Yeah, so I mean, it does sound then that it's a little bit about the complexity of consequence management and accountability in the, when it's pure public sector, while it's a lot easier when there's a contract in place in a public and private partnership. It's a weird solution for the problem of public sector accountability, but it is, it obviously does make sense.
Yeah, I think it's important to look at the strengths of both the public and private and see what we can learn from them. And Andrew, you and Tamar go beyond the NHI discussions and recommend a series of pragmatic reforms. These are inspired by six foundational areas of health economics, and we highly recommend that the listeners read this in the paper for a detailed analysis. But to summarize, what are some of the strengths and weaknesses in the public and private sectors, and what opportunities do these present for improving South Africa's health system?
Well, as we all know, one of our problems of our private hospital groups is they're expensive, and so medical scheme coverage costs keep going up every year. So one of the things that health economists need to assist in here is to look for the ways in which changing the rules of the game would contribute to more cost-effective service delivery. What needs to change to get better value for money from our private hospital systems? So one thing we've already talked about, which is that if you had broader coverage, mandatory membership of people above an income threshold or informal employment might be one way of achieving that. There are others. In other words, you want to expand participation, ensure that young and healthy people don't opt out of the medical schemes environment. But the second thing is, we need to move towards an environment in which private hospitals can employ doctors and manage costs more directly on behalf of medical schemes. So we have this very unusual arrangement by international comparison where our private hospitals operate as a contract with, if you like, profit-making consultants and service providers, dietitians, physiotherapists, every health professional other than nurses who work in the private hospital environment do so as businesses in their own right. And it creates a perverse incentive to raise costs. The hospitals want as many patients for as long as possible in their wards. Private service providers want a comfortable place from which to work and an environment in which you end up with what is called over-servicing. Now, the way you control that is to move towards a system that is a bit more like public hospitals, where there are budgets that have to be met. In many parts of the world, you have private organizations that are called health maintenance organizations that offer to provide a package of care within a budget. That is often the kind of arrangement that many elderly people end up in when they go into a retirement home or go into a facility which provides care for the disabled or elderly. We need much more innovation and much more diversification of the kinds of cost-containing provision of services that are possible when you give more flexibility to the private sector to employ doctors, clarify what they provide and price for the services that they provide. And then the last point I want to make here is there are many parts, this is a complicated industry, there are many different things that go on in services, laboratory services, radiology services, knee replacement surgery, cataract surgery. Many of these can be kind of industrialized. They can be done in a competitive environment. You can have competition for pricing around laboratory services and radiology services between the public and the private systems. We have public and private systems that don't compete with each other in those fields. And finding the services within the huge range of things that health departments and medical schemes are responsible for that can be more effectively contracted for in ways that take advantage of competitive and market-based mechanisms is how you begin to bring costs down. And these are things every country in the world is having to grapple with. Health costs are a problem throughout the world, and we can learn from international experience.
So, Andrew, I mean, in defense of medical personnel out there, especially in the private sector, Obviously, I think what you're also describing is a system that allows for overservicing. So, not saying all doctors overservice or all allies overservice, but it's a system that certainly allows and incentivizes it. So, whether you use that incentive or not, or is kind of beyond the point. One of the things that also incentivizes a lot of overservicing in the health sector is also medical legal problems, right? Fears around medical legal. Is there something there that should be looked at as well? Was that part of the MHI work that was done looking at the insurance payments that are required from doctors to protect themselves and then the overservicing that happens as kind of a, well, let me do rather do this one extra thing that takes no time out of my day to protect myself from any adverse legal action?
Well, malpractice suits and the costs associated with them and the legal processes that go with them are a problem in both the public and the private system. So our provincial health departments face very big liabilities on their balance sheets associated with claims against them,
Yeah, sure.
often for incidents in maternity wards that go back 5 or 7 years. The records are not in place, it's hard to keep track. And in the last few years, there's been quite a lot of progress, I think, in understanding the problems, addressing them, and also, not just addressing the legal challenges themselves, but also the deficiencies in services that lead to them. In the private sector, it's rather a different problem. It contributes to cost raising because physicians, especially in the obstetrics environment, have faced very high insurance costs. This has to be approached through a statutory environment that is fairer, that is less open to opportunistic legal challenges, but that recognizes that there are genuine cases that require compensation. And in both the public and the private sectors, it seems to me that one has to move towards a kind of a tribunal type resolution of these claims rather than the really expensive recourse to the courts and the long delays associated with it that characterize both the public and the private sector systems. That is a different issue from NHI, but it is a big cost raising feature of both our public and private systems that does need to be addressed.
All right. And then the other question that I just have is on, it's just a technical term that you used previously when you spoke about mandatory enrollment as a way of ensuring kind of good risk distribution within the medical schemes. Can you just clarify exactly what that means? Does that mean forcing people to take a part of their salary and enroll themselves in a medical scheme, even if they would ordinarily choose not to?
Well, in many countries, you have mandatory participation, and most European economies have moved towards some form of mandatory participation, where in effect you get penalized if you don't, either through your employment or independently join health insurance arrangement of some kind. And that's a way of dealing with that problem of people who are young and healthy and don't feel the need for health insurance opting out of the system. But as I said, it's not the only way of approaching that, and it certainly has its complications. And then you've got to be very clear about what it is that people have to cover themselves with. Maybe we should add that there's a related issue here, which is what is called the demarcation issue between medical schemes and health insurance products. So we have medical schemes.
Sure, yes.
They are obliged to follow the Medical Schemes Act. They're obliged to their prescribed minimum benefits. And then there's some exemptions for low-cost medical schemes that may not have the full coverage of a full medical scheme, but they operate in terms of the Medical Schemes Act. Alongside that, you can buy gap cover for what your medical scheme doesn't cover. You can buy a hospital plan, which provides you with some income payments in the event that you're hospitalized. And the health insurance industry has over time innovated in various ways to introduce products alongside the medical schemes environment. Now, the problem with that is that it undermines the medical scheme risk scheme. Because to the
Sure.
extent that young people opt out of the medical schemes environment and choose to protect themselves through what often is not very effective protection and is quite limited coverage in reality against the possibility of really catastrophic expenditure through insurance products, the medical schemes risk pool is weakened, and it ends up with this kind of cost spiral that we talked about earlier. So you can have these
Can I just...
voluntary services. The more that kind of innovation is happening alongside the regulated insurance environment, the more you have to look for ways of ensuring that people do contribute to the overall system. Tamil was nodding. I think she's got something to add on that.
Awesome. Yeah.
So can I just add something to that?
Please.
I think Andrew's raising a really interesting point, and very important one. That also illustrates the lack of regulatory intervention by the National Health Department while it's been pursuing NHI. Because if you look at the NHI Act, it has a specific prohibition on medical schemes covering benefits that are provided by NHI. But it's completely silent about all the other products that Andrew's just been talking about. It says nothing about gap cover or health insurance. So there's this potentially strange scenario that might unfold where medical scheme, which provides a degree of protection for its beneficiaries because it is regulated by the Council for Medical Schemes, is not allowed to cover services. And all that is left is these health insurance products, which are largely focused on primary healthcare. And they're not nearly as tightly regulated. And that kind of oddity manifests partly because there's been no real evolution in the thinking about NHI since its inception in 2007.
Mm.
So the green paper that was published in 2011, the subsequent two white papers, the draft bill that was published for comment before a bill was submitted to Parliament in 2019, and the legislation that passed through two houses of Parliament changed very little.
Mm.
And that gap, for example, was never addressed.
Can I just ask, what is the type of event that triggers a health insurance payout versus a medical scheme payout? What is the, just for my own ignorance here?
So these health insurance products are actually deemed to be doing the business of a medical scheme. This was the reason why Treasury and Health in, I think, 2016, 17, agreed on the demarcation regulations, which were intended to help consumers understand and be better protected, in the sense that these health insurance products that were offering cover, as in, you know, you pre-fund your visit to the dentist or the doctor, but they're doing business similar to medical schemes. They were supposed to move under the regulatory ambit of the Council for Medical Schemes.
Sure.
That process has still not happened.
Right.
The Council for Medical Schemes has still not developed a regulatory framework in which these products can migrate. And so they've been allowed to continue. It is a strange situation because it's a closed market. There are, I think, 11 licensed health insurance providers. No new entrants have been permitted.
Sure.
These licenses get traded between the companies that hold them and operate the products. And no low-cost benefit option framework has been developed. And there's no sign that it's imminent.
I suppose there's no data on how many of the people that have these health insurance products do not have medical scheme coverage. In other words, to what degree are they substituting versus using it as kind of a complementary service? Or is the idea that it's all substituting?
So it's a great question. So your first point about data is fantastic. There is no data on exactly who holds health insurance products, because the companies that sell them are under no obligation to report to a regulatory authority. Their health insurance products, that they fall under the insurance ombuds, and the financial sector, FSCSA.
Yeah, FSCA.
Financial Sector Conduct Authority. But they are not obliged in the way that medical schemes are to report on the number of beneficiaries, the number of principal members, what their non-healthcare costs are. But they are largely, at the moment, purchased by employers on behalf of them, their employees. They are largely people on low incomes. And so they are not buying a health insurance product covering primary healthcare and the medical scheme membership as well.
Okay, so it is, there's certainly signals that it is removing people out of the medical scheme pool.
Yes. So so there's that erosion of the risk pool, because younger and healthier people may opt for those. But then there are different class of products, which Andrew mentioned, which are called gap cover, which are health insurance products. And those are products where the insurer will risk rate members. They are not obliged to follow the prescripts of the Medical Schemes Act. So a gap cover provider can say, no, we don't want to cover you, you are too ill. And cynically, a medical scheme, a provider or an entity could potentially design gaps in its medical scheme package that will be filled by a gap cover product, and effectively start to risk rate its members that way.
Right. Okay,
Yeah.
very interesting.
So, Tamar, in addition to the issues with the regulatory environment and the data collection, in terms of adopting the series of pragmatic reforms, if we were to transition from our current dual health system into a unitary integrated health system, what other challenges would we face? I suppose the first question you have to ask is what is that unitary system and what does that look like? But whatever it is, the big challenge or the big elephant in the room is politics, right? So nothing changes without political buy-in. And any kind of reform or plan changes requires political leadership. And I mean, it's the reason why we saw the abrupt shift from social health insurance to national health insurance of Polokwane in 2007. And as Andrew alluded to, the public and private systems do a lot of things very differently. So, for example, the way an ICU is managed in a private hospital and the way it's managed in a public hospital is very different. A public hospital has a team of people, it's called a closed ICU. A private sector ICU has people coming in and out. Every specialist who attends to the patient is their own little business. This highly fragmented approach to providing healthcare is a completely different model to the state. And finding ways for those to converge requires almost a kind of cultural shift, I think, in the way people do things.
So I just want to mention two things that it feels like to me that is really going to be the things that provide the biggest challenge to an NDOH that is trying to implement this thing. And you see it, at least the first one you see in the court cases already, which is around Section 33 and the complementary role of private medical schemes. That seems to be the biggest point of contention. Can Andrew, maybe you're, as the economist, maybe better suited to answer this question. I've always wondered what the rationale was beyond the ideological for this very persistent position on the complementary role of private medical schemes from, government side. Why have they made this such an important thing, even to the point of being willing to go to court to fight for it?
I think the thinking is that if medical schemes were allowed to offer the things that are done in the national health system, then there would be very little reason for health providers, doctors and specialists, to make their services available to the national system.
Right.
I think that's an exaggerated concern, but you can understand the logic of it. It says we've got these two systems, they're segmented, we want them to be unified. And so, if you let people opt out into a better funded, more profitable private environment, you don't have queues for getting to the surgery and so on, you're just not going to solve the underlying equity problem of resources being concentrated in the private sector serving a small proportion of the population.
But if it, if
I think it's better to think about that as a challenge and think about incentives and how you combine things, how you have specialist practices that, as part of their practice, also do ward rounds in public hospitals and so on. And that is, to some extent, what goes on in well-functioning systems and in contexts where the academic health services or the tertiary hospitals also have private facilities associated with them. So it's better to think constructively about how you combine resources, how you draw on the resources of the private sector, the extraordinary good consulting and expertise capabilities of our health system as a whole, rather than put this sort of fairly arbitrary rule in place that is in practice going to be very, very difficult to implement.
Let's say there is a concession and there's a multi-fund system. The medical schemes are defined as supplementary in the Act. Does that still necessarily mean that, because the public health sector would still require increased funding to be able to act as a national health fund? So would that mean that people that currently have private medical schemes would continue to pay the private medical scheme premium, but also have this higher tax burden? Whereas in the complementary system, you can envisage a process where, because the private medical scheme can't cover what national health insurance covers, you don't pay that premium anymore and can nearly shift your premium to a tax payment or a state insurance premium towards national health insurance. So is the supplementary system more expensive at an individual level for those already in private medical scheme?
I think those are quite complex questions to think through. The broad public finance principles at stake here surely are, firstly, that the redistributive funding arrangements that underpin the health system, the sense in which those who can afford to pay tax and tax resources are consolidated in publicly available health services or in a health financing arrangement that's available to all, I think that has to be your starting point. So in a very unequal society,
sure,
it's always going to be the case that we're relying on a 20% of the population who are the main sources of tax income. So that's the main redistributive function. And clearly, as the system evolves and maybe a different mix of tax and contributory arrangements, that's going to remain central. I think it is fair, if those are the basic rules of the game, to then say those who are buying up in access to health services, buying things that can't be afforded for everybody, expensive dental care, surgery that is to some extent optional, hospital ward facilities that are more generous than can be afforded for everybody. Clearly having a cost recovery system, preferably operating through some sort of insurance arrangement, through some sort of risk pooling, that meets those kinds of costs is desirable. And then over time, as the economy grows and as capacity grows, you expand the coverage of things that are done across the system as a whole.
Right.
You do have to worry about strategies that involve, that would be perceived as double payments. That is not going to be politically saleable. And getting this right is not just about sort of tax design and technical design. It's also about offering a health financing strategy that that citizens and taxpayers see as fair.
Yeah, very interesting. And then, Tamar, just to bring us back to the point that you were also making around how different health facilities are managed between the private and the public health sector. One of the things that they talk about in the Act much more in detail, I think, in the last white paper even, is this type of semi-autonomous role of public hospitals. And this feels, I'm trying to find the right word, somewhat concerning, let's say, in terms of our public hospitals. There is very, very low trust in the ability for these to be managed. But well, we obviously have our shining stars that work very well, and we're very, very proud of them. But overall, on average, our public hospitals are not working very well. If you now have to think about making these type of semi-autonomous units in the same way, which I imagine means something about converting them into being run more like a private sector entity, maybe just not as disaggregated according to these different business units as you spoke about. What do you see in terms of that going forward? That seems like a big process that needs to happen.
So my
I think the idea behind, someone should come in on this, but I think the idea behind more independent public hospital management is about better management. It's about locating management responsibilities in the superintendent's office, in the hospital, and reducing the reliance on bureaucratic procedures that have to be routed right through provincial departments with all the complexities and costs and potentially, fraud and whatever that is associated with that. Tamar, you wanted to come in?
Yeah, I was just going to say, that's a very different proposition to the NHI Act, which proposes vesting control of hospitals, centralizing them, right? Centralizing the teaching hospitals. But you reminded me of the point I wanted to make earlier, which is that a very big part of any transition is about trust. And it's about the citizens who use the healthcare services having trusting that they will provide them with care in their hour of need. And one of the great difficulties with the big grand vision of NHI and the way it's framed at the moment is that public trust in the public health system is very low. And so there would be merit in some kind of more stepwise, incremental changes in which trust is built in a system where the government and the private sector can see what works, what doesn't, learn and improve, and build trust. And I think there have been very few examples where you see public and private sector coming together in a way where everybody gets what they need in a reasonably fair way. The COVID vaccine rollout, while not perfect, is a good example of where public and private did work well together.
Yeah.
And I think it's a pity that that trust that was garnered wasn't capitalized on, and we haven't seen any further projects that build on it that are happening right now. So I think there's an opportunity that's maybe been squandered where the health department and the private sector could have worked to do other projects together. And I think there's a willingness from the private sector, but a deep antipathy towards the private sector from the very top of the public health system, right, which makes it very difficult.
I suppose there really is a challenge posed to the public sector about, while the NHI building is being built, whatever it eventually looks like, there is a lot of gardening work that can be done around it. The data system, the management improvement, the accountability structures, PPPs that can start existing before NHI even comes into focus. I think there's a lot to be done that sits outside of the realm of the NHI dialogue even. And I think that's, I suppose, a very important point to make.
I think that's true.
I think in terms of trust, so one of the projects that was proposed by one of our key informants is to look at devising an integrated maternity service between public and private. You know, there's a reasonably consistent number of live births every year. So you know how many babies you're planning for and have a system in which you have midwife-led birthing units located in private hospitals.
Right.
You would help alleviate the medico-legal burden that obstetricians in the private sector currently face.
Right.
Because they would not be the individuals providing the care. It would be midwife-led, so it would improve care for women in the private sector who currently may believe that they are getting good service, but actually they are being over-serviced.
Sure.
There are far too many cesarean sections taking place in the private sector.
Yeah.
The last stats I saw put it at about 72%. It's a global outlier.
Yes.
Whereas women in the public health sector are not getting the specialized care they need from obstetricians because there are too few. So there's a way to bring the two together in a way that would improve care for both. Now, if you think about it, childbirth and newborn babies, it's high risk, it's high emotion.
Sure.
If you can get that right and show the public that here, the systems coming together can provide women and babies with the care they need in their hour of need, that would be a long way, I think, to building trust that you can have the two working together. And really what I'm saying is I think there are lots of opportunities like that that could be explored.
Catalyst of trust, if there ever was one. Andrew?
One also just to say is we have large parts of the public health system that are well managed, that services that are delivered, and some parts of our overall kind of health sector ecosystem, our medical research council is world class. We have excellent medical training facilities. We have specialist training capacity that is also on a par with the best in the world. And I think one of the sad things about the last decade or so has been that there's just been nowhere near enough drawing on the innovative capacity, the work that's being done both in the public and the private sector to experiment with different ways of packaging services and partnering with provincial departments, or for that matter, constructing different kinds of service delivery arrangements and financing arrangements with medical schemes. There's a lot of scope for innovation here and for getting things right over time by sort of learning by doing, and we've not done enough of that.
These are great ideas for future research, and that's what drives us at IRSA, being a research institution. So what would you say are the biggest, most interesting questions emerging from your review, and where should health economists be focusing their attention?
Well, there are lots of interesting things to work on. I mean, for the last decade or so, there's been work done on low-cost medical benefit options. How do you structure a package of benefits that might make use of public and private sector service delivery capacity, but is more affordable than the full medical scheme package that is currently regulated and prescribed? And a report on that has been published. The minister has recently asked for comments on it. He's asked for comments on it and said he doesn't think it's great. He thinks that it's just another version of doing what the public sector does already. I think that's probably a mistake, because I think that low-cost benefit schemes would lead to greater coverage and access to private health services. And so that's a flow of funding into the health system as a whole.
Yeah.
And it also relieves the burden on the public health system to some extent.
Yeah.
But the minister might have a point. It may be that what's being proposed doesn't sufficiently deal with the sort of catastrophic cover questions that always are, in some respects, the fallback responsibility of the public system. So there's an opportunity. There's some really interesting issues that are enormously important that need good economic analysis if we're to make progress on how the regulatory environment governing medical scheme packages and what they have to cover and how is done. Comparative costs and efficiency, Tamar talked earlier about how we have big data gaps here. We need to know much more about how much it costs to do different things in private hospitals or public hospitals, to really make choices about the blend of public and private facilities in meeting specific health needs. You need to be able to compare costs in a sensible way, and there's a lot of research to do there that I think is of interest. And thirdly, we talked about this demarcation issue between medical schemes and health insurance products. We don't know enough about that. And I think that's a great research topic for economists, maybe working with actuaries, working with those who understand the insurance environment, to get a better fix on what's going on, but also to get a better fix on the implications of the rules and how they might change.
I want to add, URSA is actually going to launch a health economics research project in around August or September, where we essentially want to commission a series of research papers on health economic policy and health economics. So these are good, great questions to be included in those RFPs. So these are things that people can start looking at. They might start preparing for a nice URSA research project along with a health economics conference that will occur towards the second half of next year, where these papers and others will be presented.
Okay.
That's exciting.
Yeah.
We look forward to that. And thank you very much for your time, Bashir and Andrew and Tamar. Is there anything else you would like to add?
Just to emphasize how, we've written a 50-page paper here, but this is such a big and complex industry. It's a big part of the economy, 8% or so when you add everything up of GDP. In other countries, it's much higher than that. So this is an under-researched and complex and interesting area for further work.
I would just like to add that it's probably important for health economists to think about health as being part of a broader society, right?
Mm.
So you can bring your healthcare costs down if you have better sanitation, and you can bring healthcare costs down if you have less violence and trauma. We all saw the amazing photographs of Baraguana's casualty ward during one of the hard lockdowns when there was an alcohol ban, and the casualty ward on Christmas Day, Christmas Eve, New Year, one of those, I can't remember exactly which, was completely empty for the first time in history.
Yeah.
Which really illustrated to everybody just how much trauma confronting the hospitals is born out of alcohol abuse and traffic accidents. So in thinking about the healthcare RANs and where they go and how to use them most efficiently to benefit the most people, you can't lose sight of the fact that the demands of the healthcare sector are only one set of demands on the fiscus. And if you talk to the people who work in child nutrition, they will tell you that for every RAND invested in child nutrition, the return on investment is on average 33 rand. If you talk to the people who work in basic education, they will put a compelling business case to you about how important it is to invest in the early years. So I think it's important to just see health as within the broader society.
Yeah, that definitely makes sense.
Well done.
Thank you both very much for your time. We both really appreciate having the opportunity to have you on our show. This has been incredibly insightful, and it's good to know that we have tapped into an under-researched area. Thank you so much. Thank you also to Bashir for joining us in studio. And of course, a big thank you to our listeners. If you would like to learn more about this research, please see the related content on this podcast landing page on the URSA website. And if you haven't yet, please subscribe to our social media channels on LinkedIn and Twitter. This is your host, Margot G, from the URSA podcast series. Till next time.